you've come to Moscow's famous Vedenha. Now, it's hard to define exactly what this place is. I mean, it's a park, quite clearly, but it's also an open-air museum, as well as a vision of both the past and the future. So let's find out for ourselves precisely what makes Vedenha so special.
One of the first sights to greet you in the park is perhaps the most iconic fountain in Russia. 16 golden girls, each representing a Soviet republic, decked out in their own national dress.
But Pavel, how do you tell which girl represents which republic?
That has been a bit of a mystery until recently. We can see that the girls are wearing national clothes, and each is holding a plant that's typical of her republic. One's holding cotton, another a bunch of grapes, and so on. Their placement adheres to strict logic because nothing was done at random in the Soviet Union. Their order follows the order in which these republics were listed in the Soviet Constitution of 1947 to 1948. That edition listed the republics by their population size. Back then, in the 1940s, the most populous republic was, naturally, the Russian Soviet Socialist Republic. Russia, followed by Ukraine, Belarus, Uzbekistan, and so on. And they're placed one by one to the left and to the right from Russia. So the most populous republics are facing this way, watching the crowds as they approach from the main entrance. People would enter through the main gate over there, and the first statues they saw would be those dedicated to Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine.
And is it true that each woman is based on a real-life person from that country?
There's no definite answer to this one. It's true that each statue is based on a prototype. No sculptor just makes up an image based on no one, but most likely they just use subjects they were familiar with. We know some of their names. They include ballerinas and so on, but it doesn't mean there was an official selection process. They were just girls who happened to be near the sculptor's studio at the time.
And do we know how much gold was used making this fountain? It certainly looks like there was a lot of it.
Not as much as you'd think. 6 kilograms of gold was used for the fountain.
Oh, is that it?
Yes, it's gold leaf. It's basically foil, very thin, applied to the surface of the sculptures. The statues themselves were made of bronze and treated with red lead, which bonds well with gold leaf. There are funny photographs of these sculptures in the studio where they're bright red.
So that's how, even after 70 years, it still looks like it was made yesterday.
That's right. They chose gold because it doesn't oxidize or show signs of aging.
If the fountain of friendship of the peoples is about Soviet romanticism, the idea of unity, the stone flower with its mosaics, its ornaments, its fairy tales, it has to be a pure flight of fantasy. Is that true?
Yes, it's true. What makes the stone flower fountain unique is that it has nothing to do with socialist reality. It's a fairy tale. The stone flower is the biggest fountain here in terms of pump power and surface area. It symbolizes a magic craftsman's creation, something they came up with and made with magic stones or gems.
Well, talking of which, what materials is the stone flower made of? You have these precious stones around the base that sort of glisten in the sun as well.
The creators of the fountain wanted to imitate gemstones. In fact, it's all reinforced concrete, of course, and smalto, a material that's widely used throughout Vedenha. If you look at the pavilions around you, you'll see that many are decorated with it. Smalto is a type of mosaic that consists of colored foil and glass. This mosaic is water-resistant and doesn't dull over time. So it's only an illusion of gemstones, a made-up world, which works well in this exhibition setting. It's part of a park of wonders, so to speak.
Very effective.
Of course. As you can see, the water jets change shape, which is how the fountain was originally conceived. It was also equipped with lights that would turn on at night and change color. Look at these bronze still lifes placed around the fountain. There are 16 of them. The same number of Soviet republics.
Now let's shift it up a gear. The aptly named Special Purpose Garage is home to vehicles that once carried tsars, premiers and presidents. They kept secrets, witnessed key points in history, and each one has its own story to tell.
Oh, Ekaterina, thank you so much for the opportunity to sit in such a wonderful car. I've never been in a vehicle museum quite like this one. Now tell me, what's the most prized possession in your collection here?
Peter, you're very lucky because all the exhibits in our automobile museum are real, original vehicles that still run. You have a rare chance to get inside a 1912 car. Everything about this car is unique. First, the brand, Delaunay Belville. It doesn't exist anymore, but at the turn of the 20th century, it was synonymous with high status and prestige. No surprise, the first car brought for Empress Nicholas II was a Delaunay Belville. This vehicle is the same as the one the emperor used. There are only four vehicles of this kind left in the world today, one of which is on display here.
And I've had the chance to sit in one such car. What an honor. Thank you.
See how it resembles a carriage? Mm-hmm. Back in the early 1900s, automakers designed the cases while the bodies were still being supplied by carriage makers, which is why early cars look like carriages. Another interesting thing is that the steering wheel is on the right, even though it's a French car. Back in the early 1900s, all cars had their steering wheels on the right because it was thought to be more convenient. There wasn't much oncoming traffic, but sitting on the right, the driver could keep an eye on pedestrians. I'd also like to point out this small car to you, which is also unique, like all the other cars in our museum. It's the only vehicle of its kind in Russia and is analogous to the car owned by Tsarevich Alexei Nikolaevich, the emperor's son. His grandmother, Empress Dowager Maria Fyodorovna, gave that car to her 10-year-old grandson for his name day. It's a Peugeot bébé, a baby Peugeot. It's a two-seater that can go as fast as 65 kilometers per hour and is equipped with a four-cylinder engine. Would you want to drive it in present-day Moscow?
I would, actually. Yeah. I think I'd get a lot of attention in such a car.
You wouldn't get pulled over for going over the speed limit. Its top speed is 65 kilometers per hour.
Yeah, okay. I mean, is there a seatbelt?
No, nothing like that.
Okay, they might stop me for that then.
Nothing like that. When these cars were made, active and passive safety features weren't a priority for car designers. We're talking about the dawn of the car era. Car designs varied greatly, and the job of a driver was very highly regarded because you were expected to know how to drive different makes of cars. It was a time of experimentation. They tried different approaches, looking for the most economical and ingenious solutions. Many new inventions were being rolled out and tested at the same time.
Now, each of these vehicles has borne witness to a specific period of history, Ekaterina. Is there anyone here in your collection that actually took part in a significant or dramatic historical event?
Absolutely. The cars in our collection allow us to trace the history of our country, the history of its motor industry, and the history of the people who led it. Cars from the early 20th, and I want to show you another truly unique car from the era of Joseph Stalin. It is unique in every aspect. First of all, it was the safest and most secure car of its day. You could say that engineers and designers who created it were decades ahead of their time. Before this, Stalin had used an American Packard for many years. There was a Packard 12 in service at the Kremlin's motor pool, but from 1950, Stalin switched to a Soviet-built armored state car. Look at this vehicle. See how wide the window frames are? That's because the glass is 7.5 centimeters thick. This thick, yes.
Really?
There are no ordinary window winders. Each door has a special jack mechanism. You pump it, and the window goes up. You could never lift it by hand. And if you look inside the car, you can see an entire metal structure, what is known as an armored capsule or armored frame. We have two cars in the exhibition that look very similar. One is a light, standard civilian version, while the other is this heavy armored model. But the armor is concealed, so from the outside, you would hardly be able to tell them apart. This armor protects the entire car. car. Every major component is shielded behind a metal wall like this.
It's like a tank, basically.
Yes. Yeah. We have a unique photograph showing the ballistic test diagram for armored capsule number 7. It was assembled by hand from separate sections. Each section was test fired at the range, and only after that was the whole capsule put together. The entire car is built around this metal armored capsule, almost like a Russian Matryoshka doll. So the whole vehicle is protected.
But it's heavy.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'll show you a car that was involved in a historic event. This 111G was involved in a rather grim episode. It happened on the 26th of January, 1969. That day, Moscow was welcoming the crews from the Soyuz 4 and 5 space mission. The government motorcade was entering the Kremlin through the Borovitsky Gate. The cosmonauts were traveling in a 111G like this one. A man who had decided to assassinate Leonid Brezhnev believed that Brezhnev was riding in the second car in the motorcade. He fired 11 shots at the car. What we haven't yet mentioned is that production of the unique armored cars we saw earlier had stopped in 1955. After that, neither Nikita Khrushchev nor Leonid Brezhnev used armored cars, only light, standard civilian models. So, of course, when this car came under fire from two pistols, it was badly damaged. The driver was fatally wounded and sadly died in hospital a few days later. A motorcyclist in the ceremonial escort was also wounded, but he managed to react quickly and steer his motorcycle towards the attacker. Those few seconds of confusion were enough to bring the situation under control. And the security team managed to seize the man. Leonid Brezhnev was not in the car. Unfortunately, the cosmonauts were unharmed. So this was one of the incidents in the history of the Kremlin motor pool connected with the 111G.
Certainly dramatic historic events there, Yekaterina. Yeah. So many of these cars were custom built as per an individual request. What are the most unique features of some of them?
Let me show you a truly unique car. This is a one-of-a-kind vehicle that was presented to Joseph Stalin in 1946. As a seasonal car. Its open top made it perfect for comfortable drives in the mountainous areas like Crimea or the Caucasus during the summer. When the car was first shown to Stalin, some even suggested these vehicles be used in military parades. But Stalin refused. He said the Red Army has traditions to uphold. So as long as Stalin was alive, all parades were reviewed on horseback. That changed on May 1st, 1953. During the May Day military parade, the Zeiss 110B made its debut. You could say it started the tradition of parade cars in our country. Later, special parade vehicles appeared in the Zill lineup, and today, the Auris model range as well. It all started with this model, the 110B. Later on, our cosmonauts, our heroes, were also welcomed, weather permitting, in cars like this with the top down.
It's a legendary car, then.
Yes.
And what are some of the unique features of this vehicle, Yekaterina?
First, let's look at the interior. It's beautiful, very comfortable, with a wonderful sofa-like seat. But this car has a little secret. Take a look at these compartments. What do you think they're for?
I think they're footrests for when you're traveling. You can kick back, put your feet on, and relax even more.
Most men suggest they're used to store bottles.
Oh, okay.
Another popular guess is that it's a pull-out box for passing notes to the driver when it's too noisy to talk. But in reality, this car ran so quietly that it had a special indicator light on the dashboard to show that the engine was on. That's how silent it was.
Really?
You don't feel like getting out of a car like this, right? It was a favorite among Soviet filmmakers. Lots of space, heavy build, and a very smooth ride made it ideal for shooting scenes. It even appeared in several Soviet films. On our tours, we sometimes ask visitors if they can recall where they've seen an open-top 110B like this. What a magnificent car.
And now you can tell people it's in Inland Visions as well. Ekaterina, we're stood here in front of the Aurus, probably one of the most contemporary cars here, but also the pride of the Russian automotive industry. What makes it so cool?
The Aurus is truly remarkable in every sense, an exceptional car. It was developed entirely in the Russian Federation. In 2011, NAMI, the Central Scientific Research Automobile and Automotive Engines Institute, began work on a new executive class vehicle for the country's head of state. NAMI created a unique system called Unified Modular Platform, which serves as the foundation for all Aurus vehicles. At present, four Aurus models are already in production. That's part of what makes it so distinctive. Of course, both in its original development and in ongoing updates, the very latest technologies are being used. But since this is an active vehicle used by the president, I can't go into all the technical details or secrets. Still, take my word for it, it's an impressive machine. It weighs around 7 tons, and its level of protection is closer to that of a combat helicopter than a typical car.
Once your eyes adjust to the opulence and grandeur of Vedenkha's more well-known exhibits, they come to rest on some of the park's over 100 floral symphonies, carefully composed by a dedicated team of specialists.
Lola, there are plants here that normally grow in much warmer climates. How on earth do they survive? The Moscow winters can be pretty brutal.
It's true that we have some plants that are unusual for Moscow. That's because for many decades, Vedenkha has always been a center for new selection technologies. New plants were brought here specifically with the purpose of adapting them to local conditions. Besides, the climate in the city is slightly warmer than outside city limits. That's why if the plants tend to suffer from the cold, we try to pick locations where they won't be affected by it. We surround them with other plants that are less sensitive to cold weather and can protect them.
Sort of cozy places.
That's right.
There are also plants and trees that have been here for decades, 50, 60, 70 years. Is it true that you conduct regular checkups on them and even ultrasounds?
Yes, it's true. Here we have many plants that are already quite old, especially for an urban environment. We have some oaks that are over 200 years old, and some of them are around 250 or 260 years old. The majority of the oaks are more than a century old. Of course, over such a long time, these trees have been through a lot, including bad weather. They have lost branches and can form cavities inside. We pay special attention to these trees. We regularly check them and assess their condition. If we suspect any sickness like rot that we can't see from the outside, we examine them using special devices. Essentially, it's like giving trees an ultrasound. For this, we use either a resistograph or an arbutum.
So you have a full healthcare system here for your plants.
That's absolutely right. Whenever we can see that a tree is under stress or it's getting sick, we help it using various methods.
And what are some of the rarest and most remarkable plants here in Vedenkha that a visitor can come and see?
You know, here at Vedenha, we have always collected interesting and rare plants that are unusual for both Moscow and for the country in general. We have plants from North America, such as Douglas firs, eastern hemlocks, yellowwood, and various species of nut trees that are quite uncommon for this area. We even have an exotic plant whose ancestors mixed with dinosaurs.
Really?
And here it is. This is the ginkgo biloba tree.
This one here?
Yes, it's a gymnosperm plant that grew during the time of the dinosaurs, in the era of giant ferns and club mosses. It has survived to this day, and we have one growing right here.
The leaves are a really unusual shape.
That's absolutely true. There are no other trees in the world with leaves like this.
Hello, Lilia. Peter, it's nice to meet you. You have such a large selection of different plants and flowers here. It's like a living orchestra. How many people work here and help you with that? You can't do it all by yourself.
Of course. We have about 250 people working with plants and trees.
Right. Wow. It's a huge team. So I've heard that you have around 100 different floral compositions here. How do you decide which flowers go with which ones?
Since Vedenha is a large historical site that is essentially a huge outdoor museum, our main task is not to draw all the attention away from the pavilions and the historical architecture, but rather to complement them. That's why we have made the central part of the avenue quite rich, lush, and colorful. Along the pavilions, we wanted more air and something more delicate. There we have the Buenos Aires verbena, which highlights the beauty of these pavilions and does not take away the focus from them.
Is it hard to find that balance?
Well, this is the result of years of work, because this place has been here for 85 years. This year marks its 86th anniversary. So many different techniques have been used here in different years and periods. We're doing our best to uphold the original landscape design dating back to the 1950s, and at the same time to adapt it to modern realities.
Gotcha. Well, it certainly looks fantastic, Lilia. Well done. As the sun sets on our day and Vedenha sprawls beneath us, one thing is clear. This place is much more than just a park. It's a vibrant city within a city. And thanks to the people that work here, its history is being preserved and its story continues to unfold today.